Mark Caro, and welcome to episode 178 of Caro Pop, sponsored by Revolution Brewing. If you'd like to support this podcast, please go to caropop.com, like Jerry DeSica did. Thanks, Jerry. Now it's time for part two of our mind-opening conversation with Kevin Godley. Last week, we focused on his work as a gifted singer, songwriter, and drummer with the English band 10cc. As this episode picks up, Godley and his longtime songwriting and creative partner, Lal Cream, have just left 10cc after feeling like a new song from Eric Stewart and previous Caro Pop guest Graham Gouldman was taking the band in the wrong direction. The art versus commerce tension had finally come to a head, and Godley and Cream, as they call themselves, pivoted to make a three-record concept album called Consequences. It features spoken word passages from British comic Peter Cook and spotlights the duo's guitar-transforming invention, the Gizmo. The Stewart Gouldman version of 10cc went on to have a huge hit with The Things We Do For Love. Did that catchy song's popularity give Godley and Cream pangs of regret or confirm their impulse to move on? Godley and Cream kept pushing the creative envelope even as they made more standard single albums such as L from 1977 and Freeze Frame from 1978. The latter kicks off with one of my favorite Godley and Cream songs, An Englishman in New York. It also includes the experimental I Pity Inanimate Objects, a song with a vocal melody created by what essentially is an early version of autotune.
I pity inanimate objects because they cannot move.
The 1981 album Ismism, released in the U.S. as Snack Attack, features the singles Under Your Thumb, Wedding Bells, and Snack Attack, the last of which is Godley rapping about food cravings. He tells the real-life story behind that one. Godley sings lead on most Godley and Cream songs after Cream had been out front in 10cc's early days. Because Godley and Cream didn't tour, they had to come up with another way to promote their music. So, starting with An Englishman in New York, they made wildly creative videos for their songs. Soon their services were in demand and they created memorable videos for, among others, Herbie Hancock's Rocket, The Police's Every Breath You Take and Wrapped Around Your Finger, Duran Duran's Girls on Film, Lang Chung's Everybody Have Fun Tonight, Peter Gabriel and Kate Bush's Don't Give Up, and George Harrison's When We Was Fab. Godley talks about how his collaborations with Cream on videos compared to their songwriting process. Both worlds merged on the 1985 Godley and Cream single, Cry, their biggest hit and most influential video. It uses a pre-CGI version of morphing to merge one face into another. Does Godley feel like Michael Jackson's face morphing video for Black or White lifted their idea?
You make me wanna cry.
Godley worked on the Beatles' Real Love video without Cream, and he tells what ended their partnership. He also gets into the current state of relationships among the original 10cc members. Graham Gouldman told me that he could never see them reuniting. Does Godley agree? As you'll hear, Godley has never stopped trying to create something fresh and new, and I can't wait to hear what he does next. Please enjoy part two of this Caro Pop conversation with Kevin Godley.
I should have told you all I wanted was to have some fun.
Those four albums you did in 4 years, covering so much ground and tailing so much work and then touring behind them, that's a lot. And I don't know whether it was the way your contracts were set up or whatever, but it just sort of seemed like everyone was kind of churning out an album a year, whereas like now people would take breaks and then they'd come back a year later and you do Consequences and then you'd come back for another 10cc record and that like the industry and the expectations are just different now.
Very much so. Had we have been in a similar situation further into our career, we may have been mature enough to deal with it in a different way, but that wasn't the case then. We were still very young, you know, and we were learning how to be successful, if you like, and their vision of success was different to ours. And it's just what happened. We believed in ourselves, so we bailed. It was as simple as that. It didn't. A lot of work.
It's kind of that art-pop tension I was talking about earlier, maybe.
Well, art-commerce tension. I think. Part of this was commerce. Part of it said, it's 10cc time. If you don't record now, forget about it. They'll forget you. And another year will have gone by. You know, it's commerce had crept into it during the creative part of the process, and that didn't feel comfortable.
Were they offended by your reaction to the song?
Maybe, but I mean, there was always banter, you know, because as I said earlier, you know, there were times when if something wasn't working, we'd go to the others and they could improve it. And likewise, we just had a very strong feeling about what we were doing and what we'd like to be doing, and this wasn't it.
Right. So when that album, Deceptive Bends came out, and I don't know what the deal was with how they kept the name of 10cc or whatever, but they obviously it was an ex-10cc record. It was just Eric and Graham, and then the drummer, Paul Burgess, and you know, it had Things We Do for Love, which was a huge hit. Good Morning Judge, which was a decent size hit. When you heard that stuff, did you think, oh, we could have worked our material into some of this? Or were you like, nah, this is just not what we're about, and we're glad we're not involved in it, even if it's a big hit?
Yeah, the second option, essentially. We probably at the time felt, well, yeah, that's what we figured it would sound like without us. We didn't resent it in any way, shape, or form, because we were off doing our thing. And by that time, we were probably deep into Consequences world. And we sussed that, you know, that we, creatively speaking, we'd made the right decision. Little did we know that commercially we hadn't. But that's another story. But you make these big decisions in your life, and you have to believe that where you're going is where you should be going. And in retrospect, in some ways, it wasn't. But later on, it turned out that it was. You know, had we not have left the band at that point, we probably wouldn't have found our way to where we were meant to be a few years down the line.
Right.
But you know, who knows if that would have happened, had we have stayed? Who knows?
Yeah, well, you had the more recent hit. I mean, Cry was the last hit from any of you in terms of like, a song that everyone knows. So Godly and Cream had a longevity there, actually. And you know, L came out what, in 78, was it?
Something like that.
I think Freeze Frame was 79. So, you know, in a way it's kind of like you could do with the solo Beatles stuff. You could have, you know, had this Sporting Life and then Good Morning Judge and then Sandwiches of You and then Things We Do for Love and created what a 10cc record might have sounded like, but it doesn't sound like you were really on separate tracks at that point.
We were following our own, you know, our own inspiration, I guess. And it was never the things that excited us when we were in creative mode was never somebody saying, this is going to sell 250,000 records. That didn't drive us ever.
Was one of the two of you, between you and Lal, more, you know, interested in sort of the technical electronic experiments, like something like I Pity Inanimate Objects, where you're basically singing in a monotone and it's like sort of an early version of autotune? I think Lal's playing it and the melody is going up and down based on what he's playing, even though you sang it like just as a monotone. And again, it's like, what is it, a harmonizer? But it's basically creating a song through autotune. Like, how did that come to be?
It came to be because we were in our creative mode by then was pretty much dominated by writing in the studio. So as opposed to in the old days when we'd sit opposite each other and write a song and then go and record it, we wrote in the studio and we worked with loops and we worked with sounds and we made little things happen that would inspire us. In other words, we'd record and react. We'd react and record. We'd build the whole thing up in a studio environment as opposed to doing the one thing and then completing it in the studio. It was a much more, it wasn't technical because we weren't operating the equipment. We would say, like a film director would, you know, we want something that sounds a bit purple, or we want something that rattles and is out of tempo but sounds what do distorted drums sound like? You know, we would throw questions at our engineer and have them plugging all sorts of things together to create sounds, if you know what I mean, right. And be inspired by the actual finished noises as opposed to imagining what they might sound like while we're writing a song. And we found that very creative. But to answer your question about I Pity Inanimate Objects, came about because round about that time, all studios were being fed new pieces of equipment in the hope that people might buy them and install them. And one piece of equipment came in for Surrey Sound to try, which was a harmonizer. But a small keyboard came with it, and we knew what a harmonizer did, but we didn't know what the keyboard was for. So we thought, well, I think we partially had this lyric called I Pity Inanimate Objects, but we thought, what if the vocal was inanimate? And what if I sang the whole thing? No, I don't sing a tune, I sing it all in one note. And we put that track through the harmonizer keyboard and have Lol play what I'd already sung as if that was the root sound of the instrument. And that's how it came about. It was purely down to the presence of a new piece of technical equipment.
Right. Little did you know you were anticipating the way so much stuff has been recorded later. I mean, not to that effect, but like with the auto-tune manipulation of people's tones.
Yeah. We never used it for that. Mind you, we didn't have to. Let's right. say. I mean, it sounded like a machine singing, which is interesting. But yeah, we were open to that kind of input, technical input. I mean, you know, we were still in analog land at that time, but there were all sorts of things happening, all sorts of new pieces of equipment coming along, and we were reacting to that, and also throwing ideas to push the limits of equipment, if you know what I mean.
Right.
And that's kind of the mode we were in.
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of like sequencers and electronic things like Ismism, known as Snack Attack in the U.S.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, the title track is basically a snack-oriented rap song with a lot of electronics behind it there.
Yeah.
And I heard that one on the radio here. That was getting played. I was glad to get the British import of it because I thought the cover was Ismism was much cooler than the American cover with like the flying hamburgers.
Oh, I don't remember seeing that. Ismism, the cover, was that the ones with the holes cut in it?
Yeah. Yeah. There was a white version and a black version. I have the black one.
Okay. That cover, the UK version of the album, the cover was designed by a friend of ours called Ben Kelly. Ben Kelly was the architect who designed the Hacienda Club in Manchester.
That's interesting. Yeah, no, the American album Snack Attack, you'll have to Google it, but it's got these kind of cartoonish hamburgers flying. They look kind of fiendish, but
how predictable.
So, was anything sort of shifting in the way you and Lal worked together on, you know, from one album to the next?
Well, on Ismism, something shifted in me because I slipped a disc.
Oh no.
And that song, particularly Snack Attack, was written while I was in bed for about 5 weeks. And those sessions, he had to come and pick me up from my house, and I had to kneel in the passenger seat of his car facing out the back window while he drove to his house to record it. It was, and I was in pain a lot of the time. And I sang that song or spoke that song whilst lying down on the sofa, if I remember correctly.
Mm.
So, yeah, well, let me put it this way. We were open to anything by this time. We knew we were confident enough in our own abilities to recognize something interesting and go with it. And we realized that it could come from anywhere and anything or anybody. So our filters were off. And our radar was up, and we were looking and feeling and finding and playing with anything.
And then around the same time, you've started making videos as well.
Not yet. No, we were, the first thing that connected us in a roundabout way, the sort of negative version of that, not negative, I mean the sort of mirror image of that, was somebody took a piece of music from side one of the Consequences project and used it for a cinema commercial directed by Hugh Hudson for Benson and Hedges cigarettes. And it was a great little film, and they used our music for it. And so it was a connection that hadn't been made before, and we were making sound for other people's films. Little did we know that further down the road, we'd be making film for other people's sounds. So it was, that happened before we hooked on to music video.
What was the first video that you guys got hired to do?
Well, the first video we were involved with was for a track called An Englishman in New York.
Right, which is on Freeze Frame. Frame from 79, pre-ismism. Okay.
Pre-ismism. Okay. So my my timing's a little bit out on all of this, so you've got to forgive me. So what happened there was we'd written this song, and we weren't a touring band. We never were. Godley and Cream were never a touring band. So we figured, how are we going to promote this? And the only thing we could think of was maybe we could make a short film, a performance film somehow about it. And so we sort of cooked up a very simple storyboard with ideas and took it to our record label and suggested that we do that. And surprisingly, they said yes. But they wouldn't let us direct it because we'd never directed anything before. So they got a proper director to do it. And on the day of shooting, obviously we were the performers, but our antenna were up. We were watching and listening and learning and gathering all this information and loving this process that we become a part of. We did our job, you know, we performed, but we began to understand and instinctively know that this was something that we may be able to actually do ourselves. So I'm sure we became a bit of a pain in the arse to the director, and we were saying, well, what happens if we do it this way? And if we put this kind of light on it, and how does the camera move? You know, we were subconsciously trying to take over, although it didn't seem like it at the time. And that happened even more so when it came to edit the video. We were in there going, what happens if I pull that lever? Don't pull that lever! You know, and press this button. Don't press the... And we learned everything in that experience, that whole production experience of creating a film to go with that particular piece of music. We learned the basics of everything that we would ever need to become video directors in that one extraordinary moment. Talk about light bulbs going off above our heads, but that was an extraordinary thing that happened. But our names were linked heavily to the creation of the finished thing. It was a hit all over Europe. Our first professional assignment as video directors was via Steve Strange, who Polydor, our record company, had just signed his band Visage, and they were bringing a single out called Fade to Grey, and we knew Steve around the clubs in London at the time. And he asked if we'd be interested in directing a video for Fade to Grey. And, oh, fuck, we never thought that people other than ourselves would need people other than ourselves. And we said, yes, okay. So we came up with an idea. And back then, it wasn't anything to do with, there were no marketing people, there was no person you had to go to get an idea passed. It was about trust. If an artist or a management team or a label approached you to make a video, it was because they trusted your taste. And that's exactly what we did here. It was a very small budget, about £5,000. And we went and made this film. And that record was a hit. And the rest is obvious, pretty much. People, other artists started coming to us more than anything else, probably because they felt that we could communicate with them better, actually being musicians.
Right. Like Every Breath You Take, The Police, I mean, that was, what, 83, when the album came out. So that's a huge one right there. And Wrapped Around
That was, a,
was another yeah. nice one from that record.
There were two that we did around about the same time that kicked us way up the ladder. The first one was Rocket for Herbie Hancock.
Right, I was going to mention that one too.
Yeah, and also Every Breath You Take. They were sort of two sides of the same coin. They were very different, but showed people that we can do different kinds of films. And yeah, we were pretty successful as video directors. But you know what was different about it? Doing that was the first time that we'd ever been in at the start of something. You know, making music. Pop music, rock music, call it whatever you will, have been around for a long time when we got involved in it. But this hadn't. This was something new. And we were there at the beginning and we had a chance to do exactly what we wanted to do and help it move in the right, a creative way.
It's kind of like what you were saying about sheet music. It was before everyone knew everything.
Yeah, we didn't know everything. But what we did know at that early point is that what we were contributing to people's work made a difference. And that was great to know. We weren't the work itself. We were the frame for the work. But our frames were more interesting than a lot of other directors. So we were getting hired a lot.
How did you and Lal work together on the videos? Was one of you more visual than the other, or was it all like, how did you set things up and storyboard things or whatever else you did?
It worked exactly the same as it would with writing a song. It was instinctive. And sometimes there were sort of two ways of doing it. Sometimes we would storyboard a thing from beginning to end. Other times we would give ourselves a shot list of things to cover on a shoot, knowing full well that we would go into an edit and make it work. There was always this, and it was implicit, it was never really spoken about, but we knew we had to leave playtime in all areas of making a video where we could change things, where we could try things, much as we would if we were recording something, you know? You have to leave room for mistakes, and you have to leave room for taking advantage of a moment if somebody does something in performance to cover it and make sure we use that idea. That slight edge of jeopardy had to be there. If everything we did was as exact as other people do it, it wouldn't have been as much fun.
When you recorded the song Cry and then made the video for it, in a way everything kind of came together because you had this, you know, song that people really loved, but you also had this video that seemed very ahead of its time in the way all these faces were cross-fading into each other before people were using the word morph. How did that feel when you were doing that? And did you think, oh, this is just like some other level and we're doing this for one of our own songs instead of one of, you know, Duran Duran's or whoever?
Well, it came about, that video came about in a very strange way. And the original idea for the video was to have these two well-known ice skaters called Torvill and Dean, skate to the song. That was the original idea.
Huh.
Because we didn't particularly want to be in it. Lal particularly wasn't that keen of being in on camera. And I wasn't that wild about it. So that's what we elected to do. But unfortunately, our diaries didn't match. So we had to come up with Plan B. So this was Plan B. And the idea was like, oh, fuck, what else are we going to do? It's the kind of song that anyone could sing. So why don't we just pick some faces out of a casting book, send them a cassette, and get everyone to sing it and film them? and we'll fix something. We'll make something work while we're editing it. And that's exactly what we did. We didn't quite know at that stage what it was going to become, but there was an instinct at play, again, saying that there was something in this. And that's what we did. It was during the editing process. If you watch the video, maybe the first 45 seconds to a minute, the whole face changes into another face. Then it becomes another face and another face. It's at the point where we use this device called a soft wipe, where you can make a change from the top to the bottom of the screen or open it out from the middle of the screen, that the magic came. When we discovered that, it was like, whoa, what the fuck is this? Let's do more of that, shall we? And then it became a matter of deciding which face was going to go into the next face and how, whether it would go left to right, open out, go from top to bottom or whatever. And again, it turned into something akin to the I'm Not In Love sessions, where everything we tried worked, you know, but in pictures instead of sound. And again, it was magic. I think it was an all-night edit, as sometimes they turned into back in the day.
How many faces did you have for that?
Oh, gosh, I don't know. 20? I've never counted them, actually. But we went back to a couple of times. I remember there was one guy. It was a question we asked everybody when we sent the cassettes out. Can you lip sync? And everyone came back and said, yes, 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 of course we can. And one particular guy, an old guy, said, I've never done anything other than lip sync. I'm the best lip syncer in the business. You can't sync me if I'm lip syncing, you know, that kind of crap. We should have known. As soon as he said that, he was hopeless. So he goes in all the silent bits, you know. We had a similar situation when we filmed a video for Frankie Goes to Hollywood. And we had a guy riding a camel for the Power of Love. Have you ever ridden a camel before? Yes, camels. I love camels. Me and camels are brothers. I ride nothing but camels, you know. We should have learned from Cry, right? But we didn't. Could he ride a camel? Could he fuck?
You get some good camel bloopers on that, at least?
No, just a terrified expression and a guy leading the camel just out of shot.
Wow.
But
Cry worked out. Cry worked out well. And you're still singing it, and Lala's still in it, but not he's not in it that much, and you're not in it all the time, so.
In your career, there are these little moments, and that was one of the moments that we'd done something, and at the time we didn't know how it would turn out, but it turned out really well. But again, it was not an accident, but it wasn't where we were heading. It was a swerve.
Did it feel like vindication because you guys had been following your instincts all this time, and you know, yeah. And you wound up with something that was commercially successful as well as critically, you know, embraced?
Yeah. What would have been really horrible is if we'd done something that we didn't like that was hugely successful. That would have been horrible.
But this was actually cool, so that was good.
Yeah. Well, we did it. And as with most things before we put them out, we said, yeah, that's good. That can go out. But when that happens, it goes out and a lot of other people like it, it makes it fantastic. It does. It you trust yourself even more when you carry on to the next thing that you do.
When you saw the Michael Jackson Black or White video several years later with all the morphing of the faces, did you think, oh, he's doing what we did, but with newer technology?
Yes, that's exactly what we thought. And that's exactly what happened, pretty much.
Yeah. Were you annoyed?
No, because it was a few years later. You know, it's like we had it been the next week, we would have been really pissed. But no, it was a while. It was okay. We felt like, okay, we've had some interest. Sorry, we've had some influence over this guy or whoever made his film. That was wonderful. We weren't pissed. We knew that they would compare it to Cry.
You don't know how to play the game. And you cheat. You lie. You make me want to
Carol Pop is supported by Revolution Brewing, Illinois' largest independent brewery. Revolution's popular anti-hero IPA combines five classic U.S. hop varieties with bold citrus, floral, and pine aromas. And with the weather warming up, cold time sure hits the spot. This premium lager is an all-malt beer featuring Midwest two-row barley, Mexican lager yeast, a touch of German hops, and pure Great Lakes water. The brewed low and slow badge on the can attests to a lower temperature fermentation that mellows the beer for a smoother, more flavorful sip. How was it, by the way, working on When We Was Fab, which is, you know, packed with sort of Beatle Easter eggs and, you know, you get to work with the Beatle after all this time? I mean, you've worked with Beatles before. I mean, Paul was on Freeze Frame.
It was fun. It was a lot of fun because we had this mad idea of having a wall, and George stood against the wall and arms coming through the wall and pretending to be his arms and floating off the ground and people walking by and things chasing. Again, there was this slight element of jeopardy in it. But he loved it. He had a great time. And we had a great day or so. Paul was there and Ringo was there. And it was a hoot. Elton John was there.
Right. I was going to say, Ringo and Elton John are in it. I don't remember Paul.
Yeah. But people keep saying the guy, the sort of market guy pushing a trolley full of fruit and veg, is that Paul Simon? They keep asking me. No, it wasn't Paul Simon. It was like a Paul's dead moment. That went round rumour for a while, you know. That's Paul Simon. It's not Paul Simon.
And then you worked on the Real Love one also, but I think that was just you without Lal at that point.
That's correct. That was an honour.
What led you and Lal to stop working together? And was it video stuff or music stuff or just something else?
I got an opportunity to... And we were hanging out with different people. Our friends were different. I was hanging out with a fashion crowd at the time, and the fashion industry came up with the fashion industry's answer to Live Aid. It became Fashion Aid, and the idea was to put on a fashion show at the Albert Hall featuring loads of the main fashion designers around the world at that time. And Lal wasn't into it at all. At the time, he wasn't into clothes, wasn't into fashion. But I wanted to do it. There was nothing pending on our desk at the time. So I said, I'm going to do it. I don't think it went down particularly well, but I had to do it.
Was this to perform at this thing?
No. It was to film it. It was to direct it.
Oh, so to direct the show. Okay.
Yes, exactly. What year was this, do you think? Let me see. Got to be getting on from 1988, 89 or something. I did it. I took time out to do it, much as Godley and Cream should have taken time out to do Consequences, thinking that, you know, after it had been completed, we could get back and carry on where we left off. But it took a little longer than I thought, and I encountered all sorts of editing issues because I was editing on film and video and all sorts of this and that with people I'd never worked with before on my own, and it was terrifying. But it turned out really well, and I was really pleased with it, and I enjoyed doing it on my own because I didn't have to ask anybody else's opinion. I just did what I thought was right. And that experience stuck with me. And then Godley and Cream carried on doing some interesting projects. We did an interesting project called Mondo Video. I don't know if you ever saw that.
I remember Mondo Video.
Mondo Video, yeah. Anyway, just to answer your question, a little further down the line, I was involved in... an environmental pressure group with Chrissy Hine and a number of other people called ARC. And we wanted to make a film to show what we were about. So they volunteered me to make the film. And again, it was something that I ended up doing on my own because it was my thing. And I made this extraordinary little film. It doesn't stand up technically today, but back then it did, starring Dawn French as Mother Earth, and talking as she revolved in a very accessible way about the shit we're doing to the planet, and addressing our concerns. And the film turned out really, really well. And I, this time around, I was much more confident in directing on my own and enjoyed it. And it was an echo of what happened between me and Lol and 10cc. It was an echo. It was the same kind of situation, but this time it was just me. And we'd been working together for 27 years at this point. And it was time for a change. It was painful. It was unfortunate, but it had to be done. And Lol later on agreed that it had to be done. You know, but at the time it wasn't particularly comfortable.
Were you the one who made the call?
Yeah. Because I was the one who tried to work on my own and was buzzing off. So yeah, I had to do it.
So all of these splits that happened, it seems like, at least, was there a lot of personal fallout from this? I mean, were you able to stay in touch with Lol later, and, you know, with Eric and Graham, were you in touch with them for a while? I mean, obviously you're in touch with Graham and you show up for some of the shows, but like, what's the sort of interpersonal fallout of everything?
We've kind of drifted apart, essentially, over the years. We have become who we really are at this point in our lives, I suppose. But I'm planning to split up with myself eventually. So probably will go one way and Kevin will go the other. Goodness knows what they'll be doing. But, at some point, you, like we did back in the day with 10cc, you realize that something, the steam had gone out of it. You know, the energy had gone out of it. We were at a point, I'll tell you probably the other contributing factor. We were slated to direct our first feature film. We got sent a script called Poet of Chaos, which was about the last few days in the life of John Wesley Hardin. It was a Western, and we fell in love with it. And we were storyboarding the movie, and we'd been signed up by a film company called Film Dallas. They made Kiss of the Spider Woman. And we were due to start shooting this. We were in pre-production, pretty much. And we'd cast Gary Busey as John Wesley Hardin. And we were maybe 6 weeks from starting principal photography. And he went out on his Harley Davidson riding without a helmet and had a horrible accident. And the whole thing unraveled from that part. That thing that we'd been aiming towards, I guess, for a long time, the apex of our work in music video had suddenly been torn away from us. And that, I think that took the wind out of our sails. There was nothing there to aim for.
And it's too hard to put that back together.
It didn't get pushed back together. It couldn't be pushed back together. And you know, there were other aspects to it. We'd be speaking to Robbie Robertson about doing the music for it as well, and that was going well. There was a whole sequence of events that were coming together, but they didn't. You know, I mean, it's something that happens in filmmaking all the time. But at that time in our lives, it just took the wind out of our sails. And that added to the fact that I'd started to do things on my own.
Right.
The two things didn't happen simultaneously, but they contributed to the eventual outcome.
How do you feel about Graham touring as 10cc and, you know, bringing these songs to audiences?
I love it. I mean, what he's actually doing is keeping the music alive in a live context. I've sort of contributed to the show. I've made three or four films for the show as backdrops, but I've appeared on it occasionally, right, maybe two or three times.
Yeah, I saw a video of you just this past December 24th, and you came out during Old Wild Men and sang that.
Yeah.
You know, honestly, I got chills for that. And you said, "Honey, I'm home." And you played BeautifulLoser.com from your GG06 project. And then you were back
You should watch us in March 24. We played the Albert Hall.
You did Cry also then.
Yeah, yeah. That was amazing. The sense of, it was pretty scary, but the feeling coming off the audience after performing that was fantastic. You could really, it's a very American expression, but you could feel the love.
Well, would you consider, or, you know, would it be possible to go out as part of that band and be back in 10cc in this sort of touring incarnation of bringing the music to audiences so they could hear it live?
I've never even thought about it, to tell you the truth. It's nice to drop in and out every now and again. But what I know is, the only thing I know is, and I always answer the question in the same way, is there a possibility of putting the original band back together, the original foursome? And the answer is always no. Writing with Graham and doing the piano room with Graham was a buzz. That was great because somehow we're the two people that have gravitated towards each other, even if it's been sporadically with 10 years gap between. We talk a lot, we meet up, and we're all buddies, you know. It's funny how things work out.
Are you the only two in contact with each other, as far as you know?
I'm sure Lol is probably in contact with Graham. But I honestly don't. I don't think Graham is in contact with. I know he bumped into Lol a few years ago in a rehearsal room because Lol was rehearsing with Trevor Horn on something, and Graham was rehearsing 10cc, and they had a bit of a catch up chat and stuff. But that's as far as it goes. I don't think there's any real bad feeling anymore. It's just, as I said, we've grown apart.
Right. And from what I can tell from talking with Graham, he's not in any contact with Eric Stewart.
No, I don't think so. No.
So when you say the four of you would never play again, is it because of this interpersonal, just you've drifted in your own directions, or is it?
You name it, it's everything. It would be awkward, and it would come over exactly like what it probably would be, in that they've come back together to make a few bob, you know, and whether all of us are fit enough to do it would be in question.
Mm.
You know, it's Old Wild Men.
It's true. Yeah, if you listen to the lyrics of that song, yeah.
It is true. It is true, but we're maybe not strong enough to play at the level we'd like to play, and there would always be this sort of awkwardness.
Well,
so it's not something we would think about.
So you have this one new song you did with Graham. You have Muscle Memory was an album you did that came out in 2020. Is there another album in the works in some form or other from you?
I have no idea. I don't plan ahead, if you know what I mean. If an opportunity comes to do something that interests me, then I'll jump in with both feet. Or I'll do something else, you know. I'm lucky in that at this advanced age, I'm still involved with lots of different creative pursuits. And every time I do something, it makes me feel younger.
Right.
If you know what I mean. It validates what I've always been doing, particularly if it's any good. For instance, the other thing that I did recently, and it was quite daunting, I was asked to do a lyric video for I'm Not In Love, for the new release of it, and design the sleeve for it. And I did, and came up with something rather good, I think. But it was scary because it's such an iconic track. The fact that I was part of it doesn't seem to be important when you're trying to come up with an idea for a film for it, if you know what I mean. But I did something that I was very happy with. But that's what drives me. If I can sink into something and involve myself in a pursuit that really gets me delivering it at 150%, that makes me feel real good.
And you've taken care of your voice, because when you got on stage on December 24th, you sounded like the same guy who sang Old Wild Men, you know, what, 50 years earlier.
Well, it's come true. I mean, it's one of those songs that have come full circle. And I'm singing about what's happening now as opposed to what might happen in the future. It's interesting. Somebody played me a comment I made about the song at the time on tape, and I sounded like my voice was on helium. It was kind of squeaky like that. Very strange. But you become who you're supposed to be in the end, I think. And if you're lucky enough to keep contributing and making stuff and doing stuff, then what could be better than that?
Yeah, I agree. Well, thank you so much for talking with me about all this stuff. It's been really great and, you know, inspiring too. I just love digging into sort of all the creative process stuff. And you know, that's obviously what's been driving the work all this time, was just kind of that, you know, sense of creativity and, you know, what's next, as opposed to the commerce stuff. And, you know, that's why it lasts. That's why I keep listening to it and people keep listening to it.
Well, I don't understand. I mean, there are people who make things, and there is a side to the making of things where one eye is looking at what other people are doing. I can't do that. There's no point in me doing something that other people are doing and can do better than me, if you know what I mean.
Right.
If I'm going to be making something, I might as well make something that feels, sounds, looks like it comes from who I am, and no one else is doing anything like that, then it means something. It's me trying to copy something. What's the point?
Well, I'm glad you're still pushing on and creating. And, you know, I look forward to seeing what's next, whether it's the Orson Welles movie or something else.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it. Enjoyed chatting to you.
That's all for episode 178 of Carol Pop. Thanks so much to Kevin Godley for taking us inside his creative processes with 10cc, Godley and Cream, and beyond. In February, he and Graham Gouldman released their first new song in two decades, Don't Want to Go to Heaven, under the moniker GG25. If you go to kevin-godley.com, you can learn more about him and download the 6 songs that he and Gouldman wrote and recorded together for their 2006 EP, GG06. Godley's first solo album, Muscle Memory, came out in 2020 and can now be streamed on digital sites. We look forward to his Orson Welles movie as well. Oh, and the Graham Gouldman version of 10cc just announced a U.S. tour starting in Napa, California on August 27th and including a September 5th stop at the Park West in Chicago, among other places. It wraps up in Alexandria, Virginia on September 14th. Go to 10cc.world for more information. Carol Pop is produced by Chris Swake, who also pities inanimate objects. Thanks to all who support Carol Pop. If you'd like to throw something into the Carol Pop kitty, we'd be much appreciative. You can give $24 or whatever you'd like at carolpop.com. Thanks so much for listening and being here. I'm Mark Caro. Please follow Carol Pop on the so-called socials at Carol Popcast. You can follow me as well at Mark Caro at MarkCaro. Please share this episode, subscribe, tell your friends, and tune in again next week for another Carol Pop conversation. Thanks.